really tiny print and I'm struggling to read them. I watch his face but see nothing that helps me. I wonder if he came down to the shop to check on me, changed his mind. But why would he do that? Why lie? It makes no sense. Oh, I lost that ages ago. Why don't you just buy a magnifying glass? Or reading glasses? He sounds irritated. Or are you too embarrassed to wear glasses? When did you lose it? Oh, for God's sake, Mum, what does it matter? My phone is on the worktop next to the kettle, and it vibrates with a text. I ignore it. Then my phone starts ringing. I move over and see that it is Matthew and hold the phone to my ear. What he says, speaking very quickly, is such a shock it is difficult to absorb. We need to put the television on. I am gesturing towards the shelf above the vegetable rack for the remote control. What is it? Who is it on the phone? Put the TV on, Luke. News channel. Any news channel. He is fiddling with the remote for the small flat screen that is perched on top of a bookcase full of recipe books and files. As the picture finally comes up, Luke scrolls for a news channel. There is no sound as the familiar Facebook photo of Anna fills the screen, with words scrolling beneath it. Dear God. Just like in the hotel, all that time ago. Put the sound up, Luke. Quickly. I'm reading the ticker tape of breaking news as Matthew tells me the little he knows. The scroll of words names Carl Preston as a suspect in the case of missing schoolgirl Anna Ballard. A second headline confirms that the streets around an apartment block in Spain have been sealed off by police after several gunshots were heard about an hour ago. As the volume bursts in, much too loud at first, the picture is back to the studio, where the blonde presenter is shuffling bits of paper, holding her right hand up to her earpiece. We don't know any more at the moment, Ella. I'm going to have to go. Matthew's voice in my ear is struggling to compete with the television now. But I will ring you if I hear anything more at all. The police had been hoping for a media blackout, but the neighbor who phoned the police rang the local TV station straight after. I thank him, and lower my voice to ask briefly after his baby. He says he will be back at the hospital in a few hours, but I can text if I need him. And now Luke and I just stand in shock in the kitchen, the whispered word, baby, hanging between us, as the presenter sums up what they know. It is a confused picture at the moment, but from what we understand so far, police had called at the apartment block on a small development about 2 miles outside Marbella. They had been tipped off by someone who recognized a man from recent police appeals in the UK, looking for 2 suspects wanted for questioning regarding the disappearance in London a year ago of teenager Anna Ballard. The presenter now links to a reporter on the telephone, who confirms that she is just beyond the police cordon at the scene. Why don't they link to live pictures of her? The reporter. I'm glancing at Luke. They probably don't have a camera there yet. Luke is perched on the breakfast bar stool, the remote still in his hand. Infuriatingly, the reporter repeats everything the presenter has just said, but then finally there is more information from a neighbor, an eyewitness. We heard gunshots about an hour ago, and we thought it was a terrorist attack at first. We just lay on the floor, absolutely terrified. Where were the gunshots coming from, and what exactly happened next? The television screen is now split in two, showing the presenter in London on one side, asking the questions, and a map on the other, showing the location of the apartment block a few miles outside of Marbella. I remain deeply frustrated, badly wanting to see pictures from the scene. It sounded as if the gunshots were above us, maybe the second floor, I don't know. We lay on the floor for a long time, me and my friend, and then, after what felt like hours, but was probably 10, maybe 15 minutes, there were police outside our window at the back. They beckoned us to the window and said they were getting some people out of the block. They sort of shielded us as we moved under a covered walkway behind the apartments to a safe area. That's where I am now. So are there other people still inside the apartment block? Yes, lots. I think the police only moved a few out. I think it's mostly too dangerous. I did see a couple of people running out the front, but I think they were mad. I mean, whoever is shooting could just see them from the upstairs window. They could just shoot right at them if they wanted to. And have the police said anything to you about what's going on now? No, nothing. Just to stay behind the police tapes and that they will tell us when it is safe to go back to our flat. And what can you see now from where you are? A lot of police now, some with rifles, not just their handguns. There are vans everywhere and TV people arriving too, some of them in trucks. I think everyone thought it was terrorists to start with. I mean, that's what you think, isn't it, these days? We have reports coming in, as yet unconfirmed by police, that this whole operation is about a man called Carl Preston, wanted in connection with the inquiry into missing Cornish teenager Anna Ballard. Have you heard anything about that? Yes, actually. It's what everyone is talking about on the street now. Apparently one of the people in the block recognised him from some media stuff. But if it's the guy I'm thinking of, we know him as Mark, and he's got really different hair, much lighter now. So have you seen the official police pictures of Carl Preston? I have now on my phone from all the stuff on social media, and it certainly looks like him. The face, I mean. Like I say, we know him here as Mark. He's a builder, I think, working on one of the new developments. Do you know him personally? What can you tell us about him? Not much. He sort of keeps himself to himself. I think he lives with a woman, a bit younger, a blonde woman. Yeah, I've seen her on the stairs a couple of times, but never spoken to her. I listen to this last exchange and feel the muscles in my stomach clench. Luke turns to me instantly, his eyes wide and unblinking. You don't think that could be Anna? I have no idea. But why wouldn't she run away? I mean, if it's Anna and he was holding her, she would run away, wouldn't she, when he was at work? My heart is pumping in my chest, in my fingertips, in my neck, as if the blood is all of a sudden coursing too quickly around my body, and I realize in this moment that I have always assumed the worst, that Anna is dead. This new and unexpected possibility that she could still be alive is hard to process. I need to sit down. I think we should phone Dad and get him to come home. But he's so busy. Luke already has his phone out of his pocket and is scrolling through his contacts. You need Dad here. He needs to come home. And then, as he holds the phone to his ear, apparently waiting for a reply, his expression is changing. Geez, maybe she just ran off with this guy. Carl? What? This has not occurred to me, and I feel myself frown, unable to make sense of all this. It is simply too much. The pieces of the puzzle won't fit. Well, maybe she isn't missing at all. Maybe all this guilt this past year is a waste of time, Mum. Maybe the truth is she hated her life in Cornwall and just did a bunk. Chapter 32. The Father. Henry is sitting in the back seat of the police car, staring at the familiar landmarks passing in a blur. The bus stop, the war memorial, which today has a posy of white flowers. Henry tries to think why. Is it some kind of commemoration? He can't remember. Next he watches a woman in a black Mack pushing one of those ridiculous shopping trolleys. It is tartan, green and blue, and has a wobbly wheel that makes it veer to the right. Every now and again she has to swing the contraption to the left to correct this. Henry thinks she would be better off with bags. In the front passenger seat, the detective sergeant is on the phone. Hearing just one side of the exchange is infuriating. There is clearly something significant going on, but so far he cannot work out what. Why did they suddenly let him go? Can you please tell me what the hell is going on? At last the sergeant is off the phone and turns his body so that Henry can see the side of his face. We can't say too much at the moment, Mr. Ballard, but there is a police operation underway in Spain in connection with the inquiry into your daughter's disappearance. Spain? Why Spain? I don't understand. Okay, so we were hoping for a media blackout, but things have moved on. What things? Jesus Christ. A witness has identified Carl Preston as living and working in Spain, using a false identity. The witness apparently saw a rerun of the anniversary TV appeal. The local police moved in to arrest him on our behalf. The plan was for someone from our team to go over there. It can get a bit complicated, liaising with foreign forces. There are protocols. We have to tread carefully. So, what's happened? What is he saying about Anna? Like I say, things have moved on. He's apparently resisting arrest. We have a live situation. Live situation? What the hell is that? It's being covered on the news, Mr. Ballard. Kathy is with your wife. You will be able to find out the latest when we get you home. To be honest, they probably know as much, if not more, than I do. And what about Anna? Is anyone saying anything about Anna? I'm sorry, Mr. Ballard. I don't know any more. At the farmhouse, finally, Henry sees a black and slightly battered hatchback parked outside. It belongs to Tim or Paul, he can't remember which, and Henry feels a wave of irritation. Bad enough that the family liaison officer is here. Kathy has been kind enough, but he never forgets that she is a policewoman, whereas Barbara has been way too pally with her. Henry feels his muscles tense as they sweep past the barn. He is remembering the scene with the shotgun when he was taken away. Jenny in tears, and God knows how Barbara will be with him now. What the hell is the truth, Henry? Where were you that night? But mostly his mind is whirring with all these confusing new possibilities. Spain? Only after they have stood on the doorstep for a minute or two does Henry realize that the police sergeant is expecting him to use his key. His bits and bobs were returned to him as they left the station. Henry fumbles in his pocket and finally finds it. It feels formal and odd. The front door is rarely closed, and he normally uses the side entrance through the boot room. Once in the hall, the sergeant explains that he will speak briefly to the family liaison officer and then leave, though Henry must stay at home or advise the police if he's making a trip anywhere. Any new information will be filtered through Kathy. Understood? We may well need to speak to you again very soon. Henry shrugs, and then they move into the sitting room, following the sound of the television and voices. All faces turn their way. Jenny is sitting on the right-hand sofa with Tim at her side. She has her hand up to her mouth and is very pale. Barbara is in the high-backed chair nearest the television, both her hands also up to her mouth, almost prayer-like, pressed hard against her lips. Kathy is sitting on a footstool alongside her, her hand on Barbara's back. On the television, a reporter is standing in front of what looks like a police cordon at the end of a narrow street. Bright blue sky. We now have confirmation from the police that the man at the center of this standoff is believed to be Carl Preston, wanted for question in connection with the disappearance of teenager Anna Ballard. What's going on? Henry's looking at Barbara, but she doesn't move her eyes from the television. Shut up, Dad, we need to listen. Jenny leans further forward. The reporter continues. The man is understood to live on the second floor. Shots were fired this morning when police moved in to arrest him. Some residents have managed to leave the apartment block, but many are still inside and have been warned to keep out of sight. Police have cordoned off the whole area now and have apparently advised all those within the exclusion zone to stay indoors and away from windows until this situation is resolved. What a cock-up, Henry says finally. First you let him do a runner, and now you can't even arrest him without a pantomime. Jesus Christ! Shut up, Dad! Turn it over again, Tim. There was more on the other side. That woman who thinks she saw Anna. Saw Anna? Someone seen Anna? Henry feels his heart thump, fluid in his throat suddenly, almost choking him. Oh, for Christ's sake, be quiet so we can listen! Give me the remote. Jenny now takes the remote control from Tim and changes channels. Same scene, different reporter. In the meantime, Kathy stands and moves out into the hall with the sergeant. Henry watches them close the door and is torn between listening to the television and trying to make out what they are whispering about. Henry feels his heart pumping now as he listens to this new update from the different reporter. With me now is one of the neighbors who was evacuated by police a little earlier, Amanda Jennings. Thank you for joining us, Amanda. I understand that you have seen this man, known locally as Mark, with a younger blonde woman. Yes, that's right. We've been here about 6 months. He works as a builder. I haven't seen her often. She sort of hides her face, keeps herself to herself. And have you seen the pictures of Anna Ballard? Do you think this woman could be her? The reporter is showing the witness her phone, presumably a photograph of Anna. Henry holds his breath. There is absolute silence in the room now. One beat. Two. Three. The witness is examining the photo very carefully, tilting her head.
It's Anna! He's got Anna!
Barbara's voice is high with desperation, her hands now gripping each arm of her chair.
Oh my God! He's got Anna!
No one responds, but the two police officers are now back in the doorway, also watching and listening.
I couldn't say. I'm not sure. The neighbour is shaking her head, still staring at the picture on the phone. They should not be covering it like this, Kathy says from the doorway. So irresponsible. The chances are he's watching all this and it would just wind him up.
Well, they're telling us more than you are,
Henry spits. He can feel a terrible sickness in his stomach suddenly, thinking of his daughter.
You disgust me, Dad.
He looks from face to face as the television reporter hands back to the studio, promising an update shortly. But now, the rest of the day's news. Barbara first. He stares right at her, but she will not look back at him. Does she know about the affair? Has Kathy told her? Then across to Jenny, who is crying silently, Tim's arms around her shoulders. Henry is suddenly in a bubble, not quite hearing properly. He is thinking of how sure he was until this very moment that his daughter is dead. It was terrible, and too painful to imagine her gone at first. And yet, paradoxically, there was also this tinge of relief that whatever horror had happened was over. That whatever someone had done to her was finished, in the past. That certainly had, in the strangest of ways, finally comforted him, because it was too unbearable to think of it being ongoing. He looks back now at his other daughter, sitting with Tim. He is once more thinking of them as children together, fooling about in a paddling pool in the garden. Happy times. And yet, all grown up, the two boys had both swanned off, instead of going to London to help look out for the girls. Never mind blaming Sarah, maybe none of this would have happened if the two chaps, Tim and Paul, had... Tim, I think it's probably time you went home. Tim looks bemused for a moment, but then just stands up, running his right hand through his hair.
No, sit down, Tim. I want him here. I invited him here.
Jenny is glaring at Henry, and he does not like her expression, which is something close to contempt.
This isn't Apollo 13!
Henry is surprised to hear himself roar like this.
Don't make jokes!
Barbara spits.
How could you make a joke at a time like this?
I didn't say it as a joke. I mean it. This is sick, like a peep show. Our daughter, everyone watching. Tim is still standing, looking across at Henry, who now turns to Kathy.
How could the police let this happen? Like a reality TV show. It's disgusting.
And then his voice breaks, and Henry is suddenly crying. He is thinking that if she is still alive, then God knows what has happened this past year. Awful images in his head, so dark and so terrible that he is suddenly thumping at his head with the base of his palm as if this might make them stop. His little girl. Come into the kitchen and I'll make some sweet tea. It's the shock. Kathy's voice is infuriatingly calm. I don't want tea. I want everyone to go. You, Tim, this isn't your business. I don't want you here. Nor you. He's looking at Kathy.
Kathy has to be here, Henry.
Barbara is speaking, her voice trembling.
And I agreed for Tim to come over. It's what Jenny wants. This isn't just about you, Henry.
Well, maybe if Tim hadn't disappeared on some jolly with his mates, we wouldn't be here.
There is a gasp from Tim, and from Jenny too, but Henry doesn't care. It's true. When he first championed the trip to London, he thought that Tim and Paul were going to be chaperoning the girls. They had just finished A-levels. Strong, strapping, decent boys getting ready for university. Barbara was never keen on the trip, wanted the girls to do something local and lower key, but Henry had trusted the lads. By the time the boys backed out of the trip, it was too late for Henry to say no. Anna pleaded with him to talk her mother round. But the truth... There was no way Carl and Anthony would have targeted Anna and Sarah if they hadn't been alone on the train. Henry had made the wrong call.
I'm sorry, Mr. Pallard.
Tim is standing.
It's not your fault, Tim. Don't listen to him.
Jenny is changing channels again and glancing from one parent to the other.
You need to all shut up and stop fighting. I'm sick of you two fighting. Anna could be there right now. In that flat in Spain, absolutely terrified, and all you want to do is wave guns around and shout at each other.
Barbara now gets up and moves over to sit alongside Jenny to comfort her. She is stroking her hair and turning to Henry with a pleading expression.
It's probably best I go, Jenny.
Tim is feeling in his pocket for his keys.
No, Tim.
Barbara reaches out for his arm,
Jenny wants you to stay.
No, I'm sorry, Mr. Ballard is right. Tim's voice is shaking and he's looking at Henry. I should have been there. That's why I got mad at Sarah that time, trying to pass the buck.
Oh my God, Sarah!
Jenny is suddenly taking her phone from her pocket, flipping between channels with her other hand, desperate for new information.
Has anyone been in touch with Sarah? This could tip her right over the edge again.
Chapter 33. The Friend. When she was small, Sarah was terribly afraid of the dark. She watched a film once in which an intruder hid under the bed. After that, she begged her mother to swap her bed with its creaky iron frame for a divan. No space underneath. But the bed was never changed, and the young Sarah would lift the overhanging duvet every single night to check the shadows beneath. She shared a room with Lily back then, and would often wake in the middle of the night, terrified after a bad dream. Sarah seemed to have the ability to recreate scary films, scene for vivid scene, recasting herself in the role of star victim. No matter that she knew it could not be real, it felt real. But Lily could not sleep with the light on, and so there was a terrible stalemate. Sarah would whisper in the darkness, begging to have the lamp on. When a grunt said, "No way," she would next ask to be allowed to share Lily's bed. "Please, Lily." But even when her groggy sister finally gave in, Sarah would find that she was too afraid to put her feet on the floor in the darkness, in case an arm stretched out from under the bed.
"Do you remember when you put a chair between our beds at night, so that I could get across from yours to mine after a bad dream without touching the floor?"
Sarah is looking at her sister, now older and so much skinnier and frailer. It feels as if the tables have turned somehow, and she is supposed to be the stronger one.
"Yeah, you are a right pain."
Lily smooths her skirt and smiles.
"Was that before the really bad stuff started?"
"Yeah.
It was when I got my own room."
Lily looks away to the window for a time, and they sit in silence. Sarah is thinking of the horrible paradox, how pleased she was to have her own room when they moved, so that she could keep a little nightlight on, and how horrified she is now to realize the consequence of that for Lily. She looks at her sister and thinks of their father. Sarah's phone vibrates on the table. She is worried it may be a message from the police. "It'll be Mum again. Ignore it, Sarah." But it buzzes again. And again. And again. Sarah picks up the phone, intending to switch it off completely, but the messages are not from their mother. All from different friends.
"Put on the TV.
Have you seen the news?
Are you okay? OMG, ring me.
We need to put the news on."
"Why?"
"I don't know." As Sarah waits while Lily reaches to the lower shelf of the coffee table for the remote, she is thinking that maybe their mother has upped the ante, made things worse. That maybe she has convinced the police that Sarah is really missing and they are running some kind of appeal. But as Lily finds a rolling news channel, the picture on screen is not of her. Anna. There she is again. The picture from her Facebook page, standing in front of St. Michael's Mount, her beautiful blonde hair blown back in the wind. Police have now confirmed that the armed man inside the flats is wanted in connection with the disappearance a year ago of teenager Anna Ballard, a reporter says.
Dear God, what's going on?
Lily keeps the remote in her hand, leaning forward.
I feel a bit sick.
There is the taste of coffee back in Sarah's mouth. Unpleasant now. Bile, too.
You want something? A bowl?
Not enough time. Sarah glances about and sees a waste paper bin by the side of the sofa. She grabs it just in time, retching. Once. Twice. Not real sickness, just fluid. Retching over and over.
I'll get water.
Lily is gone, presumably to the kitchen. Sarah keeps the basket on her lap and holds her breath, wondering if they are going to say that Anna's body has been found, that she really is dead. But no. There is a witness who says she has seen a young blonde woman. It makes no sense. They do not confirm that it is Anna.
just hint. Sarah changes channels, and each one seems to have a slightly different version. One witness is sure he heard 5 gunshots, another says 2. The ticker tape of headlines says there are no confirmed casualties, but a large area is still fully sealed off. Sarah checks her phone again to read the messages, in case one of her friends has more information. Facebook is going mad. Twitter too. She searches for Jenny's number in her phone. The Ballards will surely know the most. But as her finger hovers over the button to ring, she changes her mind and skims again through Facebook. Lily is now back, with iced water. Drink this. She sips the water, but the taste in her mouth remains foul, and it is as if there is some kind of distance between her and the room around her. Difficult to explain, a disconnect. She feels a little bit dizzy too, maybe the retching, her stomach. Do I need to get a doctor, Sarah? You look terrible. What did the hospital say? I think I should phone Mum. No, Lily. They said I'm okay. My liver's okay. I'm just a bit weak still, from too long in bed. When did you last eat? I don't feel hungry. Okay. No food. I'll make another hot drink, with sugar this time. Lily is standing again.
Not yet. Please don't leave me on my own again.
Sarah is surprised at the pleading in her tone. The fear. Lily must see this too, because she tilts her head and sits down alongside Sarah, taking her hand in her own. It is meant to be reassuring, but Sarah can feel her sister's hand trembling.
Oh, Sarah, did you really mean to hurt yourself with those pills? Mum said it was an accident, that you took too many tablets for a migraine. I don't know. You used to hurt yourself, didn't you? Did you really mean to?
Lily's lip is trembling also now, and she grips Sarah's hand as she turns to look at the TV.
So, what are they saying? Have they found her? It was nothing to do with Dad, then. It really was one of the men on the train.
Sarah looks at the screen and does not know how to answer. There is a picture of Carl, and the presenter is saying he is the armed man believed to be in the flat. She does not know what to think. The shot switches back to the reporter standing in front of the police tape in Spain. Again, she repeats the same stuff. Why do they do this on Rolling News? Say the same stuff time and time again, going round and round in circles. The truth is, this does not make it any better. She wants to believe Anna is alive, of course she does. But what has been happening this past year? And if they really did take her, Carl and Anthony, if this has nothing whatsoever to do with her father, then it is still Sarah's fault. She will have to tell the truth about London. She thinks back to the 4 of them in that train carriage, the flirting, catching Anthony's eye. She remembers the small tattoo at the nape of his neck, wanting so much to touch it with her nail. She remembers how very alive she felt, how when Carl and Anthony went to fetch drinks from the buffet, she said to Anna that she was glad that Tim and Paul bailed on the trip. She knew there was no way that Carl and Anthony would have joined them if Tim and Paul were around, cramping their style. But most of all, Sarah remembers desperately wanting Anthony to like her and not Anna. She thinks again of how jealous she felt watching Anna in the spotlight in school, everyone looking at how beautiful she was. How during that spell when Sarah quite fancied Paul, it was Anna he was always staring at, not her. Everyone seemed to have a crush on Anna back then. And she can feel a tear on her cheek now, as she thinks again of what she did on the train that day, to make sure that Anthony liked her the best.
I'm in big trouble, Lily.
She does not bother to wipe the tears, watching the colour of her trousers darken with the little drips.
I'm not a good person.
Don't say that, Sarah. This is not your fault.
Oh, but it is, Lily. Trust me. It is.
Chapter 34, The Private Investigator. Matthew is staring at his daughter.
She's smiling at me.
No, she's not. She's doing a poo.
Look!
He twists his body so that Sal can see better.
That's a smile.
A poo. Trust me, babies don't smile for the first few weeks.
So, do you want to try your first nappy change?
Oh, God. I don't know.
Matthew is shocked at the wave of fear. He has always promised to be hands-on, a modern dad, but he had no idea she would be this little.
Well, you've got to learn sometime. Wait until she cries and I'll supervise.
How do you know she's going to cry?
His wife looks at him as if he has not been paying attention. The intensity of the wail when it comes is still a shock. Matthew cannot understand how such small lungs can make such a loud noise. He watches the strain on his wife's face as she struggles out of bed to help him.
Still really sore?
Yeah. They've cut back on the painkillers.
Bummer.
Ask for more?
Nah, I'm okay. Gotta get on with it.
Okay, Daddy. So first you need to get absolutely everything ready.
She points out the kit alongside the changing mat, which is on a trolley beside the cot. Clean nappy, wipes, cream, nappy sack for the debris. She chants this as if it is a military operation.
She tends to cry until it's all over, so don't worry that you're hurting her. You're not.
Matthew lays his daughter on the plastic changing mat and has already forgotten the sequence, panicking as he undoes the poppers of her sleep suit.
Pull it right up high or you'll have to change that as well.
Right. Tabs on the stinky nappy first.
Oh my God! Is that colour normal?
The stench is incredible.
For now, yes. It was worse yesterday.
The poo changes colour, apparently, as she settles. Matthew is appalled.
Green poo? That can't be right, surely. Quickly, the wipes. Hold her legs up and be careful not to sweep near her fold, or you'll give her an infection.
Her fold? Dear Lord, there's so much to worry about. Matthew is wishing that he had paid more attention in the classes they attended.
I don't have enough hands.
Sal, rolling her eyes, shows him how to lift both their daughter's legs up with one hand while sweeping the new nappy in place and disposing of the debris. For some reason, a chicken comes to mind. He pushes the thought away.
Talk to her.
Doesn't seem much point to me. Matthew can hardly hear his own voice over the crying. His wife laughs.
Okay, bit of talc and some of this cream just here so she doesn't get sore.
And then, the miracle. At last, their daughter stops wailing and is holding on to Sal's ring finger, turning her eyes to the side as if looking for her mother. Matthew watches. Waits. The moment is suddenly so tender, watching their daughter's face soft and settled, that Matthew is overwhelmed by a surge of disbelief and overwhelming love for them both. He looks from one to the other in this pause, and again cannot help thinking of his work, his past, that mother whose baby was snatched, thinking of Ella, of missing Anna, her parents in Cornwall, the new lens on everything.
You okay, Matthew?
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
He helps Sal to pick up their daughter and move her back to the cot.
It gets easier, Matt.
Does it?
Yeah, when they leave home, apparently.
He laughs. She laughs.
She'll sleep for a bit now.
And then Sal eases herself gingerly back into bed.
Go on then, put the telly on. Check your case.
I'm fine, I'm getting updates by phone. He has told Sally about the drama in Spain, but has been trying desperately hard not to let it encroach on this space.
They're all talking about it, the nurses.
Are they?
Yeah, of course.
I haven't told them, you know, what you do, that you're sort of involved.
Go on, put it on.
I don't mind, really. Matthew picks up the control from the foot of her bed and tries the BBC and then Sky. A text from Melanie has confirmed the negotiating team is on site now. She's heard through Kathy, embedded with the ballads, that Carl's identity has been confirmed, though this is not being released to the media. He claims to have a hostage. Says it's Anna. Again, this has not been released publicly, though witnesses are giving interviews left, right and centre, and the police communications team are in meltdown, unable to control the situation at all.
Sounds as if it's all gotten pretty out of hand.
Yeah, wouldn't want to be in the post-mortem meeting on this one.
Do you remember you considered doing a psych degree to retrain as a negotiator?
Matthew merely smiles. It was in the early days, when he so badly regretted leaving the force, wondering if there was another way back, another role. He even did a short preliminary course, an introduction to negotiating. Fascinating.
But then the financial reality kicked in. How could he possibly afford to study when he had this new business to build?
It's all changed so much, the suicide attacks.
How do you mean?
Sal is glancing at the cot, all still quiet. Well, the gold standard for hostage situations used to be to avoid intervention at all costs. Nearly always goes pear-shaped, biggest risk for fatalities.
And now?
Well, with suicide attacks, there's nothing to negotiate. So they're learning you need to go in pretty fast. Whole different approach.
But the team in Spain now, that will be old school. I mean, he's just a criminal, this guy Carl, not a terrorist.
Yeah, sure. They'll try it by the book with him.
So how does it work then? What happens now?
She's looking at the television screen. Matthew shares what he learned, that they will probably try to use the landline, assign one key negotiator initially, work hard to build up a rapport. The aim is to calm everything down, especially when he's been trigger-happy. They won't mention Anna too much.
Why not?
The advice is to keep it all about the hostage-taker, not the hostage. Establish trust. Mentioning the hostage or hostages too much tends to rank up the stress, though in this case they might ask for evidence she's safe, given some shots were fired.
I still don't get it. How could he keep her hostage for a year without her doing a runner? Seems weird to me. Didn't they say he works on a building site? Wouldn't she make a break for it?
This is no time or place to share what Matthew is really thinking. That maybe this guy Carl ties her up, threatens her. God knows what. Victims can get psychologically damaged quickly if the abuse is extreme. Could be Stockholm Syndrome, where the victim develops a misplaced bond through the trauma. Matthew watches his wife as he says this.
I've read about that, Matt, but I still don't understand. I definitely try to get away. I'm absolutely sure I would.
Enough. Matthew switches off the telly, wanting the update, but not wanting his wife and his daughter involved in this.
Want a coffee or something from the machines?
Cappuccino. Oh, and chocolate. Nasty, sweet milk chocolate, please. Big bar. She is smiling as she says this, and Matthew feels guilty, because what he really wants is an excuse to make a couple of phone calls to Ella and Mel.
And don't stay on the phone too long while you're away. I want that coffee hot when you bring it back.
Busted. She blows him a kiss, and he wonders how he ever got this lucky. Sal has always understood what his work means to him, especially after what happened, why he left the force. He pauses, realizing only now why so many police officers struggle to balance work and home, both so important, but both so full-on, so emotionally intense. And he realizes, too, that he was right. He will never get to do the psychology degree now. He thinks of the tiny bundle in the pink baby grow, eyes drowsy, but still searching for her mother. Everything is so very different now. Life suddenly has different priorities. Yes, a different lens.
Chapter 35, The Witness. I'm glad that Tony is coming home. Luke was right. I need him. The problem is I feel so churned up, my head racing with so many thoughts. I wonder what is real now and what is paranoia. It is as if this whole past year has overloaded my system, and I can no longer think straight. Am I so stressed now that I am imagining things? The noises at the shop, being sure I am being watched, that someone actually came in and moved the secateurs, dropped the map viewer outside. Did I imagine it all? Am I conjuring these things? I don't want to believe Luke is capable of wanting to frighten me, however upset or neglected he might feel. It can't be that. So, what? I am in the comfort of the sitting room, watching it all on the big television. No, comfort is the wrong word. Nothing feels comfortable anymore. Even in bed at night, I just can't keep still, taking hours to drift off to sleep. I have taken the maximum paracetamol dose today, but they don't seem to be working. My head is still pounding. Luke is upstairs and pops down once in a while to offer a drink, probably prompted by his father by text, in the same way he's reminded of Mother's Day and my birthday. Every time he appears again at the door, I examine his expression closely, wondering if I should just ask him outright, challenge him, and get this sorted. Tell him that I won't be cross, but that I need to know. Have you been more upset with me than you're letting on? Over the sadness with Emily? Over my preoccupation with this Anna case? Did you come to the shop for some reason I can't work out? I look over at the bookcase alongside the media unit that holds the telly and the DVD player. On the top are favourite pictures. Luke as a baby, first day at school, receiving his medal for his first 10 tours. God, I was so proud that day. The schools make out it is a standard thing in Devon and Cornwall to take on the 10 tours, a walking challenge on Dartmoor, as if it is no big deal, a rite of passage for living in such a beautiful place. But the reality, to be frank, is a shock. I wouldn't want to do it in a month of Sundays, and I was surprised that Luke was so keen. He likes basketball, but is otherwise not someone you would describe as especially sporty. Never did the Scouts or anything like that. More into his music, really. For the 10 Tours Challenge, they have to walk in teams of 6, with no adult supervision, and they have to carry all their own kit to camp overnight on Dartmoor. The routes are a minimum of 35 miles, to be completed in 2 days, and the terrain is dangerous if the weather goes pear-shaped, which it very often does. The army supervises the whole thing, and there are checkpoints at each of the 10 tours to prove they have completed the route. But in between that contact, the young teams are entirely on their own, and things can, and do, go wrong. Once a girl drowned during a training exercise. It was so shocking, and there was a big review. I thought, maybe even secretly hoped, they might scrap the whole thing. But no. They just have very strict guidelines. Schools right across the southwest take part, and it gets seriously competitive. Grammar schools versus comps. Private schools versus state. Good-humoured, but serious nonetheless. Every team hopes to come in first. Fastest. The training program stretches months, as the teenagers have to build up their stamina and skill set. Map reading, fitness, camping. They have to carry tents and cooking equipment and sterilize their own water, too. Loads of kids drop out. But not our Luke. He really surprised us. Not only did he stick at it, but in the end he was made team leader. And that first expedition went so well that he went back for more. He did the 35-mile trek that first year and the tougher 45-mile challenge last year. So, yes, I was prouder than I can ever explain when he stepped up for that photograph to get his first medal. Hundreds and hundreds of teenagers milling everywhere, but I remember hearing his name over the tannoy and taking in that beam of pride on his face as he caught my eye. Right there, in the center of it all. His moment. And now? Emily has ended their relationship, and Luke feels terrible. So up and down. He was so different, so carefree, in that photograph, out there on Dartmoor. The news from Spain has been going round and round in circles for hours, and it is doing my head in. All the major channels have pulled back on the coverage, as it is getting repetitive. I keep thinking of the ballads in Cornwall. What must this be like for them? And there it is again, that knot deep within my stomach. Because this really is it, the reckoning. No escaping the fact that I was right to feel guilty. That Carl or Anthony or both of them took that girl and did God knows what. All because I made the wrong decision. Because I made a snap judgment. Because I got on my high horse over Sarah's behaviour. I can feel my lip trembling, but I chastise myself. No, Ella, this is not about you. This is about Anna. This is about facing up to it all now. The only mystery that remains, the postcards, the noises at the shop. Who has been rubbing my nose in it? The postcards cannot be from Carl or Anthony if they've been abroad all this time. So if it's not Mrs. Ballard, who? The key in the door at last. I wait for the sound of the door clicking closed. The clumping of the overnight case, And to my dismay, it is a trigger. By the time he is in the doorway, I am openly sobbing.
Oh my God, Ella, it's all right, love. I'm here now.
His arms around me. My Tony. And I am all at once grateful for those arms, and yet guilty also, because I still haven't been 100% straight with him.
There, there, love, come on now.
It's all right. I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry.
And then, after I finally get a grip, the truth pours out of me. Every single little detail this time, about hiring Matthew secretly to warn off Mrs. Ballard when I thought the postcards were from her, about going to Cornwall against Tony's advice and upsetting her, about thinking that someone was watching me at the shop but not being sure if I am simply going mad.
Right, that's it. How about we just close the shop for a little while? You take a break. We get that rip-off company to come back to check the alarms, and you listen to me.
Tony has his hands on the top of my arms, leaning in to make me look right into his face. This is awful. What's going on in Spain, I mean, and God knows how it's going to turn out. I've been listening on the radio, and Anna's parents must be going through hell. But you didn't do this, Ella. This madman Carl is doing this, not you. I don't reply. And now Luke is in the doorway. He looks pale and is shifting from one foot to the other.
Really glad you're back, Dad. And I'm really sorry I didn't come into work with you, Mum.
Please tell me you didn't go in on your own.
Tony grips my arms a little tighter, his eyes wide. There is a long pause.
Totally my bad, Dad. I've been so exhausted, so upset. But I've just put out some more feelers on Facebook to see if I can find someone to take over the job.
You haven't shared our personal stuff on Facebook, Luke?
No, no, of course not. I've just said I know of a great part-time job. I'll vet the responses. If anyone good replies, I'll pass them on to you to see what you think.
Well, that's good, Luke. Thank you. I expect your mum would rather pick her own staff, but put out feelers by all means, so long as you don't share mum's personal information. But I really don't want your mother there early on her own, meantime. Not until we know for sure how all this is going to turn out.
But it can't be the guy on the train, Dad. The person sending the postcards. Not if he's been in Spain all this time.
Could be the other guy from the train, or some random nutter. Please, Ella, just do as I ask from here on, will you?
Yes?
Tony loosens his hold and leans forward to kiss me on the forehead and to wrap his arms around me. Luke then disappears to make more coffee, and I know exactly what is going to come next from Tony. Sure enough, he is absolutely horrified that I have involved a private detective without telling him. He tries very hard not to sound angry, but the disappointment on his face kills me.
I thought you had told me everything.
I'm sorry. I honestly thought I could spare you and sort it all out myself without worrying you, Tony. With everything you've got on, Luke, this promotion.
Never mind what I've got on. I just can't believe you wouldn't tell me. And going to Cornwall? I told you that was a bad idea.
I know, and I guessed you would be cross, and I just kept digging, I suppose, trying to resolve it on my own. I do see now it was stupid to keep it from you. I'm so sorry, love. But I was honestly so sure it was Mrs. Ballard to start with, and I didn't want to make it worse for her, to get her into trouble by going to the police.
I then tell Tony everything else, that Matthew has been liaising with a contact in the force in Cornwall. It is such a huge relief not to be keeping this to myself anymore, especially as Matthew has suggested we meet after his hospital visit so that he can update me. Now I won't have to lie to Tony. Sure enough, Tony says he wants to meet him ASAP to put him straight.
What do you mean?
I don't think it's right to be liaising with someone outside the force right now.
Okay, but you might feel differently when you meet him. He's a nice man. Ex-copper and very experienced. He was the one who insisted I give the postcards to the police.
Tony is about to reply when the news presenter announces they are returning to the scene in Spain for a new development. We both turn to the television screen to see the reporter still standing by the police cordon with her hand up to her ear as if struggling to hear the link from the studio, and then there is a cut to a really shocking image. Full frame. It is a grainy photograph, as if taken from a distance, but there is no mistaking it. A tall man at the window of a second-floor flat, with a blonde woman. A gun to her head. Chapter 36. The Father. Henry Ballard was brought up by the kind of parents who believe children bounce. No cotton wool, no fussing. Best way to teach a child to swim is to throw him in the deep end. His father's favorite saying. It was this extreme faith in the innate resilience of children which saw Henry quite literally bouncing on bales of hay in the trailer behind his dad's tractor at the age of 4 and learning to drive the tractor himself when he was barely 12. Looking back now on pictures of his childhood, Henry realizes he was lucky not to be on a child protection list. Lines were definitely crossed. And yet, somehow he and his two sisters not only bounced, but thrived. Apart from a broken leg at the age of 8, when a cow kicked back as she left the dairy shed, Henry escaped largely unscathed. And so, emboldened by a general horror of a nanny state, Henry approached parenthood himself with a similar laid-back confidence. "They will be fine," he heard himself saying over and over to Barbara as she fussed and fretted over high-factor sun creams and anecdotal evidence about skin cancer risks for outside workers as their two daughters ran outside every summer morning, coming indoors only for refueling. "Farms are dangerous places, Henry," Barbara would say in return, while Henry tut-tutted. "You watch too many documentaries, Barbara." And then little Anna turned 5 and contracted pneumonia. It started as a standard cough, which Barbara reckoned came from playing in damp hay stored in a side barn, but Henry said she was making too much of it. She'll be fine. Only she wasn't. The drama peaked with 5 days in the high-dependency unit of the local hospital, including a 24-hour touch-and-go period, when, disconcertingly, none of the doctors would look the Ballards in the eye. Anna, linked by all manner of tubes to bleeping machines, looked unbearably frail as the little screen kept ringing its alarm bell to confirm that her oxygen saturation levels were very poor. The doctors explained each new strategy, including a drug that could make her heart rate race temporarily, but would apparently help her lungs. "One step at a time," the consultant said. "We fix the lungs, then we sort the heart rate." Henry is sitting in the lounge now, watching the news as he remembers so vividly, sitting in the hospital alongside Anna's bed, racked with guilt as he watched the figures on those monitors, feeling helpless, feeling sorry, sometimes praying to God, but then remembering that he wasn't really a believer, had nowhere to turn, no longer confident in the resilience of children, no longer laid back, carefree. And now no longer the same man at all after his daughter, his beautiful Anna, sat beside him in the car that day he drove her to the railway station to catch the train to London. "You disgust me, Dad." Kathy appears at the door with a large tray sporting their bright red teapot, a jug of milk, and mugs. And then, just as she places it on the coffee table in the middle of the room, someone changes the channel again, and there is an icicle through Henry's heart. A picture at the window. A man, presumably Carl, with the gun to the head of his hostage. Henry hears a strange sound escape from his own mouth, followed immediately by a much louder, horrific wail from his wife. A sound like that of a wounded animal, followed by fast and almost incoherent babbling.
"Oh my God, oh my God, my poor baby! Henry, Henry, look! Oh no, 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 we need to do something! Oh my God, tell me what we should do!"
She is standing, then sitting, then rocking, then crying, and then standing again and pacing as she talks.
"We need to go there. I need to be there. Henry, oh my God, I can't be here. I can't be in this room!"
The presenter is saying that the photograph, as yet unverified, is being circulated by a European news agency, that the man has now been clearly identified as Carl Preston, but there is yet to be official confirmation that his hostage is Anna Ballard. "They shouldn't be showing this." Kathy is taking out her phone and strides towards the hall, while Henry moves forward to try to console his wife. It's going to be all right, Barbara.
How can you say that? How can you say that? We need to go, Henry. We need to go to Spain. We can't be here. I can't be here.
By this time, Tim is trying to soothe Jenny, who is also crying. Henry catches Tim's eye, the young man also in a state of apparent shock.
We can't just go to Spain, love. Not yet. We need to be in touch with what's happening.
Henry glances about him. He is thinking that if they are on a plane, they won't be able to follow the news. He looks finally towards the door, realizing that he needs the opinion of the family liaison officer, but she is on the phone still, in the hallway.
I could take Jenny to Spain if you like. Wait for you there.
Tim is leaning forward, staring into Henry's face. Would that help? To at least have someone from the family there? Henry runs one hand through his hair, his other arm around his wife's shoulders, as she is sitting back down in the chair now, her head in her hands.
Don't know. I don't know. Let's see what Kathy thinks. This is all happening so fast. I don't know what they will advise. No, no. I don't think I like the idea of Jenny not being with us.
And then Kathy is standing in the doorway, her face pale. Henry realizes there must be more news, but her expression is not good, and for a moment he is too afraid to ask what exactly the new information might be.
Watching. Friday.
Now everyone is looking at her, and I do not like it. I do not like it at all. It is my job. Supposed to be me. Because I really understand, you see. I am the only one who knows how to watch over her properly. To keep her safe. To understand her. The only one who sees who she really is. How very, very special she is. When I see other people watching her, looking at her, smiling at her, I get this noise in my head. It is like a clicking at first, quiet clicking, and then it gets louder and louder until it sounds like thunder all around my brain. And then it thunders around the room and the sky and right out into space. It's doing that right now, getting louder, and I don't know what to do. I just need space to think. I need the noise in my head to stop, and I need all of these people to stop looking at her.
Chapter 37, The Private Investigator. Matthew feels a yawn break as he reaches for the wiper switch. Mild drizzle, the most annoying kind, especially as he keeps forgetting to change the wiper blades. The soft spray of mist is just too much for the intermittent setting, but not wet enough for the full setting. He tries the washer spray. Empty. He hears his own sigh at the squeak of protest from the screen as he switches between the two wiper speed options. Too dry. Too wet. Too dry. The radio news presenter is on the sport. Matthew checks his watch. There will be a summary of the headlines soon. Good. Bound to include the latest from Spain. Melanie has said he can phone again in case she gets an update from the family liaison officer. She is still fuming over being officially reported by the DI, which is why she is going so off-piste now. Also, she trusts Matthew. She knows he won't let her down. He thinks of Anna, takes a long, slow breath. He has a bad feeling. He looks at the clouds, drifting fast in the strong wind. And now he feels the paradox of a smile emerging on his face as he thinks next of his daughter in her silly pink hat in the hospital cot. Her temperature is apparently down a bit. Nothing to worry about, the nurses say. Just a good idea to pop her under a lamp until she learns to regulate her body temperature a little better. As he left, Sally was settling down for a doze, and little Amelie was snuggled up in her crazy pink headgear to keep her cozy under her lamp. Very sweet. Very funny. Amelie. 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 Mine, he thinks. Both mine. It still feels so surreal. A family. But, wait, the jingle for the headlines. Matthew turns up the volume so he can hear better over the annoying grind of the wipers.
The presenter summarizes what he already knows. Come on, come on, we know all this. And at last links to a reporter on the scene who is interviewing a police spokesman.